Thanks. Thank you, Jack. That was a very kind introduction. My mother would especially appreciate it because you covered all the high points. It's great to be here this morning. I'm really pleased to come to Flushing's Main Street to have an opportunity to talk to the leaders of this vibrant business community. I want to thank the Queens Chamber of Commerce and the Queens Economic Development Corporation for their help in organizing today's breakfast and for reaching out to people in this room and those we'll meet later today, the business community and academic leadership of Queens. You may have noticed some videos playing as you walked into this room. These videos are the winners of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York's contest to promote financial literacy among young adults. This year, students from LaGuardia Community College took both first and second place in the competition. The top winning video ran as a public service announcement at several movie theaters in New York cities. And all three videos are available at the New York Fed's website and, of course, on YouTube. I think this is an impressive achievement, and I really do applaud the students and LaGuardia Community College in taking this up. Although some people, I think, may refer to Queens as an outer borough, I'm quite aware that the center of population in New York City is in Maspeth, Queens. Of course, Queens is special not just for the central location, but also for its extraordinary diversity. Queens continues to serve as a land of opportunity for immigrants from all over the world. Roughly, by our measure, 46% of Queens' population is foreign-born. That's more than four times the national average, and it's higher than for any other county in the United States, with the exception of Miami-Dade County. We have sizable communities of immigrants here from countries ranging from Colombia to Korea, Ecuador to Egypt, Greece to Guyana, and Italy to India. They've all made Queens their home. This diversity is one important element that makes Queens and New York City so very special. You could say we are at the cosmopolitan center of the world here. This morning I'm going to talk to you about national and regional economic conditions, and of course, as always, what I have to say reflects my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. That's pretty much in every speech I give. By way of introduction, let me start by describing what the New York Fed is. Jack described it a little bit, what we do and what makes my job so interesting. The New York Fed is part of the Federal Reserve System. That's America's central bank. We were established by Congress back in 1913, so our 100th year anniversary is coming up. With this act, Congress delegated to the Fed system its constitutional authority to manage the supply of money in the nation's economy. And Congress designed the central bank to be decentralized, to represent all of the United States and independent of the political process. The Fed system is composed in really two distinct parts, the Board of Governors that's in Washington, D.C. That's a federal agency currently led by Chairman Ben Bernanke, plus 12 Federal Reserve banks that span the country. So the district overseen by the New York Fed includes all of New York State, the 12 northern counties of New Jersey, Fairfield County, Connecticut, and Puerto Rico in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Each reserve bank is distinct with its own charter and board of directors drawn from its districts, but we are overseen by the Board of Governors. The law that created the Federal Reserve made the central bank independent so that policymakers could make decisions about monetary policy in the national interest, somewhat insulated from political pressure. However, the Fed is accountable to Congress. In that regard, Congress has set an explicit objective for monetary policy to pursue the highest level of employment consistent with price stability. This objective is often referred to as our dual mandate because it combines two different goals, high employment and low and stable inflation. In order to promote these objectives, we also pay important attention to financial stability because without financial stability, as we saw during the financial crisis, it's very hard to achieve our goals with respect to jobs and inflation. So the FOMC consists of the Board of Governors plus the presidents of the Federal Open Market Committee consists of the Board of Governors plus the 12 Federal Reserve presidents. It meets in Washington eight times a year. We have a meeting next week to deliberate and vote on monetary policy. As the New York Fed president, I'm vice chairman of that committee, and I get to vote at each meeting. At these meetings, the committee members and I present our current outlook for the economy. And for these assessments, we don't just rely on our research departments. We come out to neighborhoods like this and to hear what people have to say about what's going on in terms of local economic conditions. My visit today is very definitely part of this consultative process. One thing that makes my job even more interesting is that New York has some very special roles within the Federal Reserve System. For example, We're the bank that's charged with actually implementing monetary policy. So the Board of Governors, the Federal Open Market Committee decides, and the New York Fed makes it so. At the direction of the Federal Open Market Committee, we buy and sell Treasury securities. We're also the eyes and ears of the Fed on Wall Street. We supervise some of the largest financial institutions in the country. We also operate Fedwire, which is a payments platform that allows banks to send large dollar payments among themselves. And we provide banking services to the U.S. Treasury and central banks and governments around the world. You know, New York Fed District, as I mentioned, is one of the most diverse within the system. We've got the density of New York City. We've got the sparseness of the northern Adirondacks. We've got the Caribbean islands of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. So all in all, there's lots to keep us very, very busy, even in normal times. So what is the outlook for economic activity, employment, and inflation? In particular, what are the areas of vulnerability that we should be most concerned about? Well, the good news is I am pleased to say that the economic outlook has improved considerably over the past 6 months. Despite this, we are still far away from achieving our dual mandate of maximum employment and price stability. Faster progress towards those objectives would be very welcome. But on the activity side, a wide range of indicators show a broadening and strengthening of demand by households and production by firms. So, for example, on the demand side of the equation, families boosted their consumption in the fourth quarter at a 4.1% annual rate. That's nearly double the rate in the first three quarters of 2010. Not surprising, as demand picks up, businesses' orders and production are following suit. And this revival in activity, in turn, has been accompanied by improving consumer and business confidence. Combined, this contributed to growth in the fourth quarter of 2.8%. I actually suspect that growth rate of 2.8% understates how much momentum the economy actually has, because we got that growth despite a very, very sharp slowing in the rate of inventory accumulation, which pulled down the growth rate in the fourth quarter. In my view, what we're seeing in terms of the revival in demand and production and confidence strongly suggests that we may be much closer to establishing a virtuous circle that will support stronger growth. What I have in mind by this idea of a virtuous circle is one in which rising household and business demand generates more employment growth and income, which in turn bolsters confidence, which leads to further increases in spending. The only missing piece of the puzzle in this regard is we haven't really seen very strong employment growth as yet. We'll need to see strong employment growth in order to be certain that this virtuous circle has been firmly established. Now, with respect to the last labor market, last Friday's report was more promising. It did help resolve some conflicting signals. Over the last few months, on one hand, we've seen the unemployment rate fall very sharply from 9.8% to 8.9%. That's one of the sharpest falls that we've ever seen in such a short period of time in U.S. economic history. On the other hand, payroll employment growth gains, this is a separate survey, have been pretty modest, and they have not really been consistent with the big drop that we've seen in the unemployment rate. Well, last Friday, we learned that the economy added 192,000 jobs in February, and estimates of previous job growth for prior months were actually revised up a bit. So this is particularly encouraging, as is the growth that we're seeing in manufacturing employment. Over the past year, we've actually added factory jobs at the fastest rate since the 1990s, so more than a decade. The February figures really make me more confident that the weakness in job growth that we saw in January is really mostly due to the really poor weather we had. Everybody in this region, it was one of the most miserable Januaries. Other labor market indicators, such as initial claims for unemployment insurance, the employment components of other surveys that we do of manufacturing and the non-manufacturing sectors, also show improvement in labor market conditions. So I think we can be more confident there. Although there still is uncertainty over the timing and speed of the labor market recovery, though, I expect that job growth will increase considerably more rapidly in coming months. And we should be very much welcome this. A substantial pickup in job growth is sorely needed. Even if we were to generate growth of 300,000 jobs per month, we would still have considerable slack in the labor market at the end of 2012. So why is the economy finally showing more signs of life? In my view, the improvement really reflects three developments. First, household and financial institution balance sheets continue to improve. On the household side, the 2008-2009 rise in the savings rate appears to have stabilized in the 5 to 6% range. Meanwhile, the amount of money that households need to service their debts for mortgages, cars, credit cards, has fallen sharply to levels that prevailed back in the mid-1990s. Debt service has been pushed lower by a combination of things, including debt repayment, refinancing at lower interest rates, and debt write-offs. Financial institutions have strengthened their balance sheet through retained earnings and by issuing equity. As a result, we're finally seeing some measures of bank credit beginning to expand again. Second, monetary policy and fiscal policy have provided important support to the recovery. On the monetary policy side, we at the Fed have maintained unusually low short-term interest rates, and we've engaged in large-scale asset purchases. These measures have helped foster a sharp improvement in financial market conditions. For example, the stock market has risen sharply since last summer. And on the fiscal side, that's government spending and taxes, the economy has been supported by a shift in policy at the federal level towards greater fiscal stimulus in order to support growth. In particular, we saw a temporary reduction in payroll employment taxes at the beginning of the year, and that could have a pretty strong impact on growth during the first half of 2011. The third positive is that growth abroad, especially among emerging market economies, has been very strong, and this has led to an increase in demand for U.S. goods and services. Over the four quarters of 2010, real exports rose at over a 9% annual rate. And after a disappointing performance earlier in the year, net exports, so the difference between exports and imports, surged in the fourth quarter. The firming in economic activity, in short, is due both to natural healing process following the crisis and past and present policy support. In this regard, it's important to emphasize that we at the Fed have been expecting the economy to strengthen. We provided the additional monetary policy stimulus via the large-scale asset purchase program to help ensure that the recovery did, in fact, gain momentum. A stronger recovery with more rapid progress to our dual mandate objectives is what we are seeking, and this is a welcome development and not a reason to reverse course. Yet, it's important that we don't become overly optimistic about the growth outlook. The coast is not completely clear. The healing process in the aftermath of the crisis does take time, and there are several areas of vulnerability and weakness. In particular, housing activity remains unusually weak, and home prices have begun to soften again in many parts of the country. State and local government finances remain under stress, and this is likely to lead to further spending cuts, tax increases, and job losses in this sector that will offset at least part of the federal fiscal stimulus. And we cannot rule out the possibility of further shocks from abroad. For example, higher oil prices cut into household purchasing power, and the situation in the Middle East and in northern Africa remains uncertain and dynamic. Also, we can't ignore the risks stemming from the long-term fiscal challenges that we face here in the United States. But in the near term, the most immediate domestic problems may recede rather than become more prevalent. On the housing side, stronger growth should lead to more household formation. For example, more young people, if they get jobs, will be able to move out of their parents' homes. This trend should provide more support to housing demand. And anxieties about the large overhang of unsold homes, represented by the foreclosure pipeline, may overstate the amount of excess supply of housing. Families that have lost their homes through foreclosures are likely to seek new homes as their income permits, even though many may reenter the housing market as renters rather than as buyers. On the state and local side, a rising economy should boost sales and income tax revenue and help narrow near-term fiscal deficits. We also need, as we go forward, to remain watchful for signs that the low level of interest rates that we have in place right now could foster a buildup of financial excesses or bubbles that might pose a medium-term risk to both full employment and price stability. Fortunately, on that front, the current risk spreads on U.S. financial assets are not unduly compressed. This suggests that people are still being relatively cautious about taking on a lot of financial asset risk. On the inflation side of the ledger, there are some signs that core inflation, so that's inflation excluding food and energy, is now stabilizing after falling for the past few years. At the Fed, we focus on core inflation, which excludes energy and food prices, because experience and research tells us that core inflation provides the best measure of whether overall inflation pressures are rising or falling. Core inflation has proven quite reliable in predicting future total or headline inflation. And at the moment, both headline and core inflation remain below levels consistent with our dual mandate objectives, which most members of the FOMC consider to be 2% or a bit less when we use on the basis of the, what's called the personal consumption expenditure. Recent evidence shows that the large amount of slack in the economy has contributed to declining inflation over the past few years. I expect this slack to continue to dampen price pressures over the near term. Inflation expectations are well anchored today, and we intend to keep it that way. A sustained rise in medium-term inflation expectations would represent a threat to our price stability mandate, and we would not be tolerated. We always need to be careful about inflation, even in an environment of ample spare capacity. In that regard, let me focus on one issue, commodity prices, for a moment. I'm sure there are many people in the audience today that have faced the challenges of sharply rising oil, food, and metal prices in recent months. For example, the spot GSCI, which is a broad measure of commodity prices, has risen more than 35% over the past year. This was in train even before the recent upheavals in the Middle East and Northern Africa raised market concerns about disruption to oil supplies, which have pushed energy prices still higher. Commodity price pressures are pushing measures of headline inflation above core inflation, which, as I mentioned, exclude food and energy prices. You may have concerns that the rise in commodity prices will turn out to be persistent, and if so, this could potentially impact the inflation outlook. Now, from a policymaking standpoint, there are important factors that suggest that it would be unwise for us at the Federal Reserve to overreact to recent commodity price pressures by raising interest rates soon. You might ask why. Well, first, despite the general uptrend, some of the commodity price pressures are likely to be temporary due to poor weather or political uncertainties. This is certainly what's anticipated by market participants. For example, they expect good food harvest this year and food prices to come back down as we go into 2012. Second, even if commodity price pressures were to prove persistent, they're likely to have a much smaller impact in the United States than they do in many other countries. Relative to most other major economies, the U.S. inflation rate today is lower, the amount of slack is much greater, and commodities represent a relatively small share of our consumption basket. This small share helps to explain why the pass-through of commodity prices into core measures of inflation has been very low in the United States for several decades. Third, the Federal Reserve's success in anchoring inflation expectations has been important in limiting this pass-through of commodity price pressures into core inflation. Since 1994, for example, when the Federal Reserve began to achieve success in driving down and then subsequently anchoring long-term inflation expectations, there's really been very little evidence of commodity prices as passing through into core inflation. Now, in contrast, prior to 1984, when inflation expectations were much less well anchored, pass-through did occur, and at times did play an important role in pushing underlying inflation higher. So while commodity prices may be giving some of you a bad headache, this is not likely to lead to a sustained rise in inflation to levels inconsistent with our dual mandate. We do, though, have to ensure that these pressures do not cause inflation expectations themselves to become unanchored. If that were to occur, that would be a troublesome development that would complicate our pursuit of our dual mandate of high employment and low and stable inflation. Because we have an FOMC meeting next Tuesday, I will not comment today on the implications of the economic outlook for monetary policy. So now let's turn to the situation here in the city and in Queens in particular. While the national economic outlook improved considerably during the latter part of 2010 and into this year, growth in New York City's economy actually appears to have slowed a bit. The regional economists at our bank have developed a composite economic index for New York City. It incorporates measures such as unemployment, unemployment, income, and it really can serve as a barometer of how the economy here is doing. Based on this measures, the city's economic activity, which had declined fairly sharply throughout much of 2008 and all of 2009, rebounded at a pretty encouraging pace during the first half of 2010. Growth slowed in the second half of last year, but recently released employment data point to some pickup in the city's economy early in 2011, and the data suggests that the economic recovery in the city remains on track. Over the past year, employment in the city has expanded fairly strongly in a number of key industries, including finance, professional and business services, education and health, and tourism, including air transportation. Job losses in construction and government, however, continue to weigh down employment growth. Meanwhile, the New York City unemployment rate has edged down steadily over the past year, though it remains unacceptably high at 8.9%. Unfortunately, as is true in much of the rest of the country, much of the recent drop that we've seen in the unemployment rate here has come from people withdrawing from the labor market so that they are no longer counted as unemployed. It's true that some of the unemployed have been able to find jobs, but not in large numbers thus far. So where do Queens residents find employment? While many of them commute to work in other boroughs, primarily Manhattan, Queens does have a formidable industrial base of its own. As home to the city's two major airports, LaGuardia and JFK, the volume of air traffic coming through Queens ranks the third highest among U.S. counties. So not surprisingly then, transportation is Queens' largest industrial specialty. It accounts for 12% of total employment. That's four times the national average. And air transportation alone accounts for 6% of Queens' jobs. That's 15 times the nationwide share for air transportation. But that oversimplifies the situation in Queens, because Queens does have a diverse economy. There are jobs and businesses ranging from medical care to construction, not to mention printing. And there's a number of other manufacturing industries that benefit from being in such a large population center. Now, during the recent recessions, Queens' dynamic economy was hard hit, yet it proved more resilient than Manhattan's and much of the region. From the peak to trough, the unemployment rate, unemployment declined by about 3% in Queens, far less than the roughly 7% plunge in employment that we saw at the national level, and less than the 4.5% loss in employment that we saw in New York City as a whole. Although we don't have borough-specific economic data that's quite as current as the citywide data, we do see from the data that we have that employment in Queens stopped declining during the first half of 2010. And we're hopeful that upcoming reports will show a sustained upturn. With the prospects of the national economy improving in 2011, the outlook for Queens' diverse and vibrant economy and New York City as a whole seems to be brightening as well. So in conclusion, to sum up, the national economy experienced a pickup in activity during the last quarter of 2010 that shows signs of continuing into 2011. And although the city's economy saw some loss of momentum, I would not be overly discouraged by that. After all, soft patches are not uncommon during economic recoveries. Now, it's true both nationally and regionally unemployment remains stubbornly high, but there are many indicators that suggest that conditions are in place for stronger growth in coming months, and that will be very welcome. Thank you very much for your kind attention, and I'd be very happy to take a few questions.
Good morning and welcome to Queens. We spoke earlier before you had a chance to get up and give your presentation. I'm an assemblyman in Eastern Queens, and one of the questions that small businesses in the district that I represent frequently bring to me, and I hear this from individual consumers, homeowners as well, is the lack of availability of credit. It's been written about and spoken about on a national level, but I would love to hear your thoughts on whether or not what people perceive to be a credit crunch is really true, and if so, what your insights might be into how that will get alleviated so that businesses who want to hire can borrow and invest in capital, and homeowners and individual consumers can have access to capital so that the economy can grow.
So the question is about the availability of credit to finance the activities of small businesses, including their hiring. There's no question that there was a significant constraint on the availability of credit to small businesses, especially in the immediate aftermath of the financial crisis. We do a survey of lending conditions, and we saw for many months in a row banks tightening their lending standards. And small businesses were particularly hurt because a lot of startup small businesses rely on things like home equity loan lines of credit, and credit cards to finance their startup operations. So we went through a very, very bad stretch. We're not completely through it, But I do see, what we do see is that banks are now starting to ease their lending standards. And we are starting to see a little bit of thawing in terms of creditability to business. Now, obviously, the weakness in home prices continues to be a problem. And so I don't think this is going to turn around very quickly. But I would say the worst is past. And for smaller businesses that are already up and running, I think they're, you know, have a track record. I think for them, they'll find that credit, I think, is actually reasonably available today. But it's particularly the startup business that's still going to have trouble finding credit. So things are getting better. So things are getting better, but they're not what I would say where we want them to be. You know, when we have a financial crisis of this type of magnitude, it usually takes several years for the healing process to be complete. So I think we're out of the emergency room. We're out of intensive care. Maybe we're even out of the hospital, but we're still not fully recovered yet.
Is there anything that the Fed can do in terms of your role in lending money and making money available to banks to make sure that they then turn around and actually lend them to businesses and consumers?
Well, we've done a number of things. One, we have set the level of short-term rates at a very low level to make credit affordable. Two, we've bought large-scale, we've purchased assets to augment the Fed's balance sheet to reduce longer-term interest rates. We supplied a large amount of bank reserves to the banking system, so the banks have plenty of liquidity to go out and lend. And we've tried to encourage banks not to, you know, overdo it. You know, during the boom, you know, lending standards get very, very loose. And when you have the bust, the things swing back wildly in the other direction. And we've been very, very clear to banks that we don't want them to overdo it. They have to do prudent lending, but they shouldn't overdo it in terms of how they react to the crisis. If you look at the bank credit numbers, we're actually starting to see, you know, signs of stability, and now start to see very small signs of an uptick in certain measures. So, you know, the news isn't good, but it's considerably better than where we've been.
To his question, sir, the basis of the financial meltdown was the predatory and the other lending packages. This, of course, has hit Queens and Southeast Queens, where I represent a great deal. I'm Councilman James Sanders, Jr., former chair of economic development for the City Council. Under Chair Blair, there was more of an activist nature of the Fed. There was far more activists. What can the New York Fed especially, and the Fed in particular, but the New York Fed do to become far more active on this approach? The banks are not modifying the loans, sir. They are not. Every statistic, everything is saying the same thing. What can you do to go back into the Blair tradition of a more active approach to get these banks to modify these loans?
Well, there's a lot of efforts underway to examine what exactly went wrong in terms of the mortgage market, especially in terms of mortgage servicing, and to basically hold the banks accountable for what transpired. And there is some discussion that you've probably seen in the press that there could be a settlement that could actually be used to finance mortgage modifications. And so there is a process underway that I have some hope that will be, you know, helpful in this respect.
Well, you're seeing the pushback by the Bank of America on that very issue, sir. I have the financial document from the federal government, the research that had been done on the cause. But the banks are pushing back. Somebody has to bite the bullet. Is it a question of the investors? Is it a question of the banks? Some question of government, if you wish. The idea of a bad bank or something has to occur. Otherwise, we never will get out of this financial crisis. And the Fed can take a far more active role in this, sir.
I think that mortgage modifications are definitely part of the solution of getting the housing sector back on its feet. It's complicated though, because the mortgages are dispersed, and it's hard to coordinate all the pieces, as we've seen. I mean, the administration's had a number of initiatives in terms of mortgage modifications, and it's been hard to sort of press this forward. There is, as I mentioned, there is another
looks like there's another initiative sort of underway, and I'm hopeful that that can make more progress, because I do think it is an important part of the solution in getting housing back on its feet. So thank you.
Thank you for coming to Queens, sir.
Morning. I'd like to ask a question about the dollar. We talk about commodity prices, and obviously they're pegged to the dollar. At 76, 77, 78 cents right now that we're trading to the euro, the price of oil, the price of gold is obviously much more expensive than if the dollar was propped up and trading more towards parity. What are we going to do as a country, as the Federal Reserve, to increase the price of this dollar, buying dollars, bringing down the federal deficit, making this country a stronger country again?
Well, the issue with valuation of the dollar is really the province of the U.S. Treasury, not the Federal Reserve. The Treasury sets a foreign exchange policy for the United States, so I'm not going to comment on where the dollar should be. It's true that when we set monetary policy in pursuit of our dual objectives of price stability and full employment, that it can have consequences for the dollar that we have to take into consideration in terms of how we set monetary policy. But the dollar is really not the primary goal of U.S. monetary policy. It's really the province of the U.S. Treasury. So you should talk to my former predecessor at the New York Fed.
Thank you.
All right, I'm Thomas Bach. I asked this question on behalf of myself, like you started out in your speech, not on behalf of my company or on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce. But given your dual mandate to control inflation while optimizing employment, the Fed engages in the buying of U.S. treasuries through your quantitative easing program. This feeds the federal government's appetite for spending, whether it's bailing out industries or giving handouts to favored political groups through so-called stimulus. I'm no economist, but if common sense tells me that if the Fed, through the purchase of treasuries, is flooding the economy with dollars, not backed by any good or service, then it has to drive inflation. It has to be debasing the value of the currency. And if energy and food commodities, which are sold on world markets and priced in U.S. dollars, if those U.S. dollars are worth less and less and less, it's not due to poor weather or to external shocks. It is
Let me answer your
that
question.
Businesses are failing, people are unemployed.
It's more of a speech than a question.
The world are starving.
Okay, the Fed engaged in large-scale asset purchases for a very simple reason. We could not push short-term interest rates any lower because we were already basically at zero. So in that situation, how could we make monetary policy more stimulative to push the economy closer to full employment? By buying treasuries, took long-term treasuries off the market that pushed down long-term interest rates, which stimulated the stock market, led to narrower credit spreads, and helped stimulate the economy. Now, people worry that these purchases are going to ultimately be inflationary, and I don't think they have anything to worry about for a couple of reasons. So let me explain. This is very, very important. This is like absolutely critical. In the old days, if we had done what we had done and created lots of reserves in the banking system, we would not be able to raise short-term interest rates. And at some point, when the economy picked up speed, interest rates would be too low and the economy would overheat and we'd have a lot of inflation. But in the fall of 2008, we got a new tool, the ability to pay interest on excess reserves. So even though today we've added lots of excess reserves to the banking system, we can control how those reserves lead to credit expansion and how those reserves lead to credit expansion and potentially inflation. If we see the economy starting to overheat, we can raise the interest rate we pay on excess reserves, and those reserves will stay with us rather than being lent out into the economy and causing the economy to overheat. So the money banking book textbooks that were written prior to October 2008 are obsolete. We have a new tool, and we're going to use that tool in a way to make sure we don't have an inflation problem, even if we have an enlarged balance sheet. So there really is nothing to be worried about. You're not the only one who's brought up this issue, and I think it's a serious one that we need to address, but the world has changed. We have new tools. And just in case that tool we have, the interest on excess reserves, is not sufficient, we also, that's our belt. We also have a pair of suspenders. We've also developed a number of tools to actually drain the excess reserves from the banking system if we need to. So we are absolutely determined to prevent any long-term inflation problem. We're not going to let it happen. Not only do we have the tools in place to prevent it, we have the will to make sure that doesn't happen. So I certainly acknowledge your concern. If I thought that what you were describing had any chance of happening, I would never have done the large-scale asset purchases. Because that would have been irresponsible.
When was the last time, sir, that you went food shopping? Let's say. I mean, I was just in my supermarket the other day, and I bought paper towels and a couple of food items. I couldn't believe the price. Even the woman at the checkout counter was saying it's incredible how prices have risen. So, as common folk, when we go shopping. Just by that, a mere shopping exercise, you can see the inflation that's hit our economy.
No, I acknowledge. I mean, there's no question that I acknowledge that food price. Let's have someone else have a shot.
Thank you for being here. I guess you're getting a little bit of abuse, and I might as well add to it. My name's John Poston. I'm a financial advisor. And I took a seminar last week, and the fellow who talked to the seminar said, does everybody drink orange juice? We said, yeah. He said, we all buy X brand, 64-ounce container. He said, go home and look at it. It's 58 ounces today, same price. There definitely is inflation. Consumer confidence is down. What can you do to alleviate or to help with consumer confidence? I think that's one of the biggest problems today. We're a consumer-driven society and economy, and we've got to start there.
Okay, look, I certainly acknowledge that food prices have gone up, but a lot, people also forget that other prices are going down. Today, you could buy an iPad 2 that costs the same price as iPad 1, that's twice as powerful than the old thing. So, you have to look at all the prices of all goods and services, and not just focus on the ones that are particularly annoying when you go into the food store. If you look at total prices in the U.S. economy over the last year, they're rising at only about 1.5%. So yes, some prices are rising quite rapidly, but other prices are actually declining. I think the key, I think consumer confidence is extremely important in terms of generating a sustainable economic recovery. And we've been doing everything in our power on the monetary policy side to provide support to the economy so we can generate more, easier financial conditions that supports demand. As demand grows, that leads to jobs. It just leads to jobs, it leads to income, and it leads to higher confidence. We've actually seen that the last 6 months. Confidence has really started to recover over the last 6 months. So we're pretty close to getting this virtuous circle going. I'm not sure we're absolutely certain that we're there, but things are definitely a lot better than they were 6 to 12 months ago. All right, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.